An important part of cooking is putting together compatible flavors and textures, but the best pairings aren't always evident to home chefs. In her latest book, The Vegetarian Flavor Bible, two-time James Beard Award-winning author Karen Page provides an expansive, immersive, and innovative guide for many of the ingredients we eat every day. The book, more reference guide than recipe manual, offers hints, flavor profiles, and cooking suggestions from everything from acai berries to zucchini blossoms. It even features seasonal suggestions for a wide range of cuisines. And Karen joins us now, along with one of the book's experts, Terrence Brennan, the chef owner of Picheline, a two-star Michelin guide restaurant here in New York City. The Vegetarian Flavor Bible is published by Little Brown, and I'm very pleased to welcome Karen and Terrence back to our program. Hello.
Thank you so much for having us. Always a pleasure and a thrill.
Karen, your last book, The Flavor Bible, was a huge success, won a number of awards. Have you followed the model and structure of that for this one?
Almost exactly, because it seemed to work so well for readers. They got the innovative sense that you can look up anything alphabetically in the book from A to Z, as you said, and find the herbs, spices, and other seasonings that best enhance the flavor of all of them. What we've done is added, in this case, gorgeous four-color photos from my husband, Andrew Dornenberg, who's exhibiting different talents this time around with this book.
Former chef.
Former chef and wonderful collaborator. And I've added an introduction on nutrition. I've added a chapter on great events in vegetarian and vegan history, and added sort of a contemporary current events chapter looking at some of the trends that are coming together that are resulting in this whole movement.
Are these things that you just had to leave out of the previous book for space, or are these things that have occurred to you since you've actually become a vegetarian yourself?
Oh, a little bit even before that, because I've been working on the book for years, and I've only been eating vegetarian since May of 2012. So a lot of it has come as a result of what I've been learning through being a practicing vegetarian, per se. But also just before that, just the wanting to find out where this interest in vegetable-driven cuisine is coming from and all the factors that are driving it into restaurants like Picheline and Per Se and Danielle and 11 Madison Park.
Because this isn't a recipe book, can't these profiles be added to meat dishes?
Absolutely. Yes. In some ways, anybody who uses the Flavor Bible is going to love the Vegetarian Flavor Bible, because this is the book 6 years later and incorporates a whole host of ingredients like quinoa and other whole grains, other vegetables, fruits, legumes that weren't really in the book when it came out in 2008.
Terrence, a lot of top-level restaurants have started including vegetarian tasting menus and the like. Is that because you had customers asking you for vegetarian food?
That's a good part of it. I mean, as a chef, we start at the market, whether we're doing vegetarian or a meat dish. It always starts with, for me anyway, and most chefs, with vegetables and at the market, how do you compose the dish? So there over the years, there has been more of a demand, so much so is that I always would accommodate vegetarians or vegans.
Well, but you always had vegetables
right.
in the
so
kitchen.
So we'd always just do something al minuture. We'll do this, we'll do that, no problem, no issue. But it was we saw such a trend that we decided, you know what, let's go ahead and do a menu, write a menu. And then from there, we had tasty menus of 5 and 8 courses, 12 courses, but the vegetarians still had their, four or five dishes we did and say, you know what, let's show them a little more respect and give them the tasty menu. So we matched up 5-course, 8-course tasty menus so they can do dual tasty menus when they come to the restaurant.
Often vegetables are still cooked with chicken stocks and the like, so you had to find things that would give those kinds of dishes the same kind of intense flavor that you get naturally from a stock.
Right, absolutely. Being traditionally classically trained, a typical, say a soup would have a chicken stock in it, like butternut squash or cauliflower. So even before I really thought a lot more about vegetables and vegetarianism and et cetera, you do a delicate soup like cauliflower, and you taste it, and you want the flavor, the cauliflower to come through, not that, even if the chicken stock is in the background. So I started that a while ago. However, now when I design menus, I really, really think of, can this be a vegetarian dish easily? Because, for example, in our current soup now, we use a squash soup. It's a pumpkin soup, so we use pumpkin stock. We used to use vegetable stock. We graduated to pumpkin stock. And even we don't use any gelatin, say if it's a flan or something, we'll use something else besides that, so it can remain vegetarian.
And then do you have to do even more tweaking if it's a vegan?
Yes, that's a whole other kind of little challenge. I mean, the current menu, luckily it just happened to be like, oh wow, all the six entrees that we have that are vegetarian, it can absolutely be made vegan without sacrificing the creativity of the dish, because we can do anything vegan, but is it going to taste good? Is it going to be creative? Is it going to represent what we do at Pischling? Well, they feel slighted if they see a beautiful plate of protein or meat over, and they get this plate of just basically mixed vegetables. So a lot more thought goes into the vegetarian menus and dishes.
Terrence talked about a pumpkin stock, although I'd be curious to know what goes into a pumpkin stock. Do you have many different kinds of suggestions for vegetarian stocks here?
Well, I think it gets very specific, because I think what chefs are finding is that as they're looking to increase flavor, they're moving away from, as Terrence Brennan is, moving away from the meat-based stock, whether it's a beef stock or a chicken stock or a fish stock, depending on the dish, and moving more specifically into a stock that's going to enhance the flavor of whatever it is they're cooking.
Which you could also do if you're serving meat.
Sure,
could do vegetables vegetable stock and then put a piece of meat on the
absolutely.
Side.
Absolutely. But this way, I think you're seeing chefs think more modularly about their cooking, because they're getting so much demand across the country from vegetarian and vegan guests. And rather than starting out with a stock that's going to be a turnoff to a growing percentage of their guests, they're starting out with that vegetable stock or the vegan stock and being able to add things to it for their omnivorous guests.
My guests are Karen Page, whose latest book is The Vegetarian Flavor Bible, and Terrence Brennan, one of the chefs whose thinking is featured in this book. He's the owner of Pischling, actually a number of restaurants here, Artisanal. Another one. Yeah. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Terrence, you have really featured cheeses as a major part of what you offer at both Pischling and especially at Artisanal.
Yes, yes.
Vegans can't eat cheeses.
Vegan cannot, no. So we certainly have a larger percentage of vegetarians than vegan. But as I saw 5 or 6, 7 years ago, how the popularity of vegetarian was increasing, I'm now seeing that with veganism. So now I even give a little more thought to that. But yes, they can't have cheese, and we look for other things. Like I think about, how can I add creaminess to a dish, for example? So we'll do a cashew cheese, for example. We'll whip cashew into whisk into a sauce so it feels creamy and rich, but there's no butter or cream. And that's a real challenge. Or we'll do smoked onion puree to emulate, say, smoked bacon in a dish.
Because butter, those kinds of fats really do automatically add a lot of flavor to a dish.
Well, butter, not so much flavor, but more a richness to it, the viscosity of a dish or something. But butter is a for me, when you add cream of butter, it actually takes away flavors. Because if you taste cream, it tastes like, if you're finishing a sauce with cream or a soup, you're going to dilute whatever base that is with cream.
Karen, the book lists an ingredients, flavor, nutritional profile, botanical relatives, potential substitutes, even lists of flavor affinities. What are flavor affinities?
Well, we refer to flavor pairings in the book as we had in the Flavor Bible. The Vegetarian Flavor Bible refers to the flavor pairings as two ingredients that go well together. So tomato and basil, or cucumber and dill, things that just really matches made in heaven, we like to call them. Flavor affinities refer to groups of three or more flavors that really all are very compatible click together. So when you think of ingredients like five spice powder, those five spices go so well together that they're known as a click of flavors. So we've got plenty of those in the book, and their usefulness is that whether you're making a pasta or making a pizza, you can throw these combinations of flavors into that dish and be confident that they'll all go well together.
Do the pairings stay the same across all methods of cooking?
In some cases, I don't know if I can think of the exception to the rule. I think in virtually all cases, you'll find that compatibility that will transcend cold dishes, hot dishes, savory dishes across the board.
You also talk about loud vegetables. What are loud vegetables?
Well, we've used this nomenclature for the Flavor Bible, where we talk about the fact that certain ingredients are quiet, like tofu, and other ingredients are loud, like wasabi. And so you get the sense of how do you need to organize your strategy for working with that particular flavor.
But even within the same vegetables, young arugula will be a lot quieter than older arugula.
Absolutely, which is part of the reason that the Flavor Bible exists, is that recipes in some cases are insane because every ingredient will differ. How can you say that you need to cook something for 2 minutes versus 10 minutes if you don't know if it's a summer arugula or a later season arugula?
Is this something you think about a lot, Terrence, whether you're going to use a large carrot or one of those little teeny carrots?
What we think about, is what's at the market. So if we get a large carrot, it's really about taste. So whatever's tasting the best, the sweetest, say, for example, carrots, it could be a medium-sized carrot or it could be a younger carrot. So it depends on what we're doing with it, how we're going to present it, et cetera.
Do you have a favorite volume range for your dishes? Is balance important?
Oh, balance is the utmost important. That's what we always strive to do with a dish. It's all about balance, and it's about yin and yang, and soft and crunchy, and salt and sweet, and balance is that's what it's all about. It's bringing it all together to where they harmonize and have some surprises as well.
Well, Karen, you talked about how certain things have been known for a long time, like cucumbers and dill, but in researching this book, were there any surprises?
There were actually lots of surprises, and I think it's amazing how much the world has changed in the last 6 years since the Flavor Bible came out. I was embarrassed to go through the Flavor Bible and realize that we hadn't included an entry for quinoa, because we'd first written about quinoa in 1996 in our book Culinary Artistry, which was the first book that Andrew and I were on this show with. And so for some reason, it wasn't quite on the map the way it certainly is today, as people are looking to get more grains, they're looking to get away from, in some cases, gluten grains, and looking to other alternatives. And so we do indicate for each of the grains that are mentioned in the Vegetarian Flavor Bible which have gluten, which are gluten-free. And as you mentioned, the nutritional profile, so people can really choose, not just by flavor, but also by healthfulness, which I no longer believe are mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Chefs have so many more things to be concerned about these days, as we mentioned, vegetarianism, veganism, but also many people, I'm sure, are asking for gluten-free things.
Oh yeah, that's a biggie. So we have gluten-free.
You have to
bread.
Add staff.
Not yet.
Gluten-free department.
Although I am going to have a sous chef in charge of all the vegetables, and in charge of, because we really even want to put more effort into the tasty menus and do more complicated and exciting vegetarian dishes. So that's going to be something new.
My guests are Terrence Brennan, who's the chef owner of a number of restaurants in New York, Pichelin, also Artisanal. Still 2 stars in Michelin?
Oh, no, we're one now.
Uh-huh. Well, I
think Michelin is quite mistaken on that one.
Getting any Michelin
star. That's
okay.
You know what's great about that is that you get the opportunity every year. So we're looking forward to getting those back and maybe one more on top of that.
Bravo.
Well, they don't take away James Beard Awards. You've won 2, Karen?
2 for becoming a chef, and then the Flavor Bible.
And now we have the Vegetarian Flavor Bible, written by Karen Page, with photographs by Andrew Dornenberg, published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Mm-hmm. And we are back with Karen Page, whose latest book is The Vegetarian Flavor Bible, published by Little Brown. Terrence Brennan, chef, owner of Picheline and Artisanal. Karen, you write about something called the X Factor. What's that?
I dissect the idea of flavor as being distinct from taste and other aspects of it, because a lot of people use those two terms interchangeably, of flavor and taste. But in fact, taste is just one component of flavor in addition to aroma, which makes up a significant part of it, and mouthfeel, and the X factor, as you say. So that refers to everything that is not taste or aroma or mouthfeel.
Is this umami?
Umami is actually considered one of the five tastes now. We've evolved from the four tastes of sweet, sour, salty, bitter to include umami. And then beyond that, we talk about all other kinds of things. Like, you know, when you're talking about something like smokiness, I tend to think of that as being aromatically based. And herbaceousness, also very aromatically based when you're talking about things like fresh herbs.
What about presentation, plating? Is that part of the X factor?
Sometimes.
Because a plate can come to your, be put in front of you that makes you really want to eat the thing, and then that same, those same things won't look as appetizing if it's plated differently.
Absolutely. I mean, that happens to me when I go to Picheline. It's a real problem because he's got this wonderful sense of whimsy in his plating, and it's always great to see how things are presented. But I think that your appetite starts when you look at a dish. You're either attracted to it or you're repelled by it. Sometimes color plays a role. There's color psychology that if you are served a berry dish that's redder than another berry dish, the intensity of flavor is perceived to be increased as well.
And I'm sure that even the color and shape of the dish is important.
Yes, I mean, it's all important. I mean, the utmost important, though, is the flavor. That's what we start with. So I'll never put something on the plate for color, for example, because I need a green on it. It's all on the, it has a purpose on the plate. And then from there, we try and make it as beautiful as possible.
Well, Arthur Schwartz, when he was a restaurant critic at the Daily News, said the difference between the old restaurant approach and the new one was, in the old one, they would put the piece of meat on one side of the plate and the potatoes on the other side of the plate.
Yes.
And the newer version, they put the potatoes in the middle and they put the piece of meat on top of it.
Well, we call composed plates as opposed to just like, you know, a fish with a sauce and a, you know, a garnish.
Yeah. Karen, early in the book, you have a list of substitutes for meats that readers may be craving. If you want pork fat, the book suggests toasted sesame oil instead of chopped liver. Try walnut, lentil, pate. Mm-hmm. Is texture and flavor similarity more important when you're thinking about substitutes?
It's so important. It's really working on this book has really changed the way I've thought about flavor. Actually, stopping eating meat for the most part in May 2012 was really change the way I think about flavor, because I used to think that I craved meat. You know, I'm a Midwestern girl. I grew up outside of Detroit eating meat at least two or three times a day. And I actually never thought I could go vegetarian. And so when I finally did, I thought that what I was going to miss most was meat. But what I found that I actually missed was the crispiness of bacon, the chewiness of certain, you know, a ground beef, or the smokiness of some of the ham or pork products. And I find that you can get all of those things. Once you deconstruct the flavors and the textures, you can get all of those things from plant-based foods. So there's no reason for me to eat meat ever again since I'm so satisfied by what I've been able to find in vegetarian tasting menus and other vegetarian and vegan restaurants.
Kosher dairy restaurants for years came up with substitutes, fake steaks made with vegetables, but they never really did it. Do you do that sort of thing,
no,
Terrence?
No. I'll play with tofu. I'll play with other proteins, like plant-based, but not like
actually, you use that wonderful portobello mushroom instead of a steak. That's a great dish. Could you describe that?
Which one?
The one, I think it's got like a cream spinach on it and a potato.
Oh, that's
and
really
portobellos
fun.
Are often used as a substitute
back
for steak.
Right, that was a few years ago.
Yes.
And that was, we did the steak garnish dish, right? We had onion rings.
Onion rings on it.
And cream spinach.
And it's wonderful because that's really what you crave. I mean, I don't miss going to steak restaurants with the possible exception of Michael LaMonaco's Porterhouse, but he does one of the best mushroom risottos around, so I'm always happy to go there.
Yeah.
You miss, you know, the creamy spinach, you miss the onion rings, and to get that in a restaurant like Picheline was a lot of fun.
And then sometimes when you do tongue-in-cheek, you suggest a dish that's that's made from meat, already you get the guest thinking, like, you know, in that mindset. And I think there's a bit of placebo effect too. If you were talking about earlier with the, you know, kind of the play on flavors and whatnot, and people expect one thing, they're gonna, it's almost like a placebo effect where they're just gonna go ahead and confirm that when they eat it.
Exactly, yeah. It sort of enhances the game that we're playing. Right. Okay, this portobello mushroom is actually a steak, and the cream spinach and the potatoes and the fried onion rings on the plate really all serve.
Then you
to
do is do a side of A1 sauce, which I just thought of right now, but we should have served it with A1 sauce.
But you have to think about the spicing that goes with it. Right. Do you find yourself using more spicing to zip up the flavor of vegetables?
I kind of use that. We're French Mediterranean, so I use a lot of Mediterranean spices anyway and herbs. But when I go through, I'm gonna have to finish reading the Vegetarian Bible and get some more ideas with the spice combinations.
Do you make tartars, like a beet tartar or a mushroom tartar?
Yes, we've done that many, many years ago. We did a beet tartar with grabiche and caviar, but you can't have caviar. But we've done...
Actually, they have vegan caviar now, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
Yeah, made with, you know, the techniques of molecular gastronomy.
Oh, yeah.
Taught us spherification. You take it,
caviar in quotes.
Caviar in quotes, exactly. But made with kelp and a little, you know, a few chemicals, and there you go.
Yeah. So it's made with chemicals. Chemicals are okay.
Well, I mean, they use it in the molecular gastronomy cuisine. I don't know that it's something that I want to eat on a daily basis, but it's something that's served in restaurants all around the world, thanks to Ferran Adria and all of his imitators.
You also have guides to seasons. Since it's autumn, you suggest baking, braising, glazing, and roasting. Terrence, what are your favorite combinations for this time of year? Other than using kale, which seems to be in every restaurant all the time.
Right. I almost don't even want to have kale anywhere because I don't want to be trendy. I think of vegetables and cooking like I would meat. So a lot more roasting in the fall. Sauces, for example. Karen, last time you came in, we did a roast celery, whole roasted celery in a salt crust and served it with a mushroom bordelaise. So, I do a lot more sauces in the fall with my regular menu. So a little more sauces, and it was very fall looking with mushrooms and a dark red wine sauce as I would serve with meat.
People don't realize how great celeriac is, because it's so it's kind of ugly.
It's
vegetable.
Ugly. Yes, it is. But it's one of my favorite fall winter vegetables for sure.
The book also features sea vegetables.
Yes, exactly.
Well, seaweed is really big in Nordic culture, Nordic cooking, and also in Japanese cuisine. Why don't we eat more seaweed, considering the fact that it's so rich in iron?
Exactly. Well, a lot of the vegetarian restaurants across the country have been serving it for a long time. So I think there's a lot that today's haute cuisine chefs are learning from what the vegetarian and vegan restaurants of yore have been pioneering. And now I think you're seeing it. You've seen it a lot of in Japanese restaurants, macrobiotic restaurants. But now you're seeing it in more mainstream restaurants as they're realizing that it's a way to get those marine flavors, if you will, salinity, and then some of the other notes of the sea in a plant-based dish.
I have it in two dishes. One is the sea urchin panna cotta, which we serve seaweed, plus we infuse seaweed into the lobster stock to make the panna cotta base. And then another dish.
Of course, vegetarians can't eat that.
Right, but they can eat the eggplant with the pho dashi, which we put seaweed in and other things to get that umami flavor like dashi. Mm-hmm. But it's
now,
vegetarian.
You have a large section on mushrooms.
Huge.
That's because
and
mushrooms,
half pages, I think it is.
They present so many different tastes. Is this a good time of year for mushrooms?
Yes.
I think every time of year is good for mushrooms if you're hearty. But absolutely in the fall, I think of it as a great mushroom season. And it's interesting because in the Flavor Bible, we obviously mentioned mushrooms, but not to the degree and not to the types of mushrooms that we have represented in the Vegetarian Flavor Bible, which I think when you're not eating meat, you turn to other ingredients, and especially mushrooms because of their, I want to say, meatiness in quotes or their savoriness, that it's so satisfying to a lot of people who are eating that way. And you've got options like chicken of the woods and hen of the woods mushrooms that have some notes of chicken and some of the same texture characteristics as chicken. And so if you're a newly turned vegetarian who's still missing some of those flavors, it's a nice way to get them from a plant-based ingredient. Lobster mushrooms, the same. You'll get notes of lobster. They have that lobster color. Oyster mushrooms, you'll get some of the suggestions of oysters. And as Terrence Brennan had just pointed out, that you'll kind of, if you're serving it in a particular context with compatible flavors to the original, it's easier to buy them in that guise in a plant-based dish.
Well, are you buying them that way, or are you just simply trying to come up with interesting dishes?
What do you mean buying them?
In other words, hey, I'll do a kind of a chickeny dish, so I'll do hen of the woods.
Oh, okay. I first get the product in, and then we think, like, what are we going to do? Okay, it has to go. Let's be tongue-in-cheek and do a chicken dish, or let's be tongue-in-cheek and let's do lobster thermidor, but with, you know, lobster mushrooms, for example.
Now, apples are really kind of big this time of year. And Karen, you list a range of pairings: brandy, cheese, cinnamon, but horseradish?
Horseradish, sure, and more savory applications. And I think there's a great sidebar in the book from Charlene Badman, who's the chef at F&B Restaurant in Scottsdale. And she talks about the four key elements of making a great salad, and one of them is sweetness. And you can get that sweetness through a touch of honey in the dressing, or a touch of maple syrup in the dressing, or more frequently through fruit. And fruit is very frequently added to greens, to nuts, to rich components like cheese, either dairy cheese or vegan cheese. And, oh, by the way, just coming around to the vegan cheese conversation, I will say I finally had the first vegan cheese that I fell in love with, and it's spelled with a Z. It was made by a woman named Lori Robin in the Woodstock area, and she's got a company called Cheese Hound with a Z. Sells at the local farmers markets up there. I'm begging her to come and sell at the Union Square Green
Market. What does it taste like? What kind of cheese?
It's a brie-style cheese. It's made with, I think, half... I mean, she doesn't give the exact recipe out. Of course, it's proprietary, but it's like half hemp seed milk and half macadamia nut milk. So the hemp seed aspect of it, you get a real nuttiness to it. And then the macadamia nut, you get an incredible richness. But she does a brie style that's peppercorn flavored. It knocked my socks off. Wow. I would, knowing that Terrence Brennan is a cheese hound that he is, I would, with pride, bring him a sample of it just to see what he thought.
Absolutely.
It is that delicious.
Oh, yeah.
Picheline worthy, in my opinion.
Oh, wow.
My guests are Terrence Brennan of Picheline and Artisanal, and Karen Page, whose latest book is The Vegetarian Flavor Bible. Not recipes, but pairings. Also substitutions. And I've spoken to a number of people who said, you know, the best squash for pumpkin pie is never pumpkin. What do you think about substituting other squash for the things that the taste?
I think it's perfectly fine, because you just want to go what vegetable is best for what, which application. But if you're going to call it a pumpkin pie and use an acorn squash, then there's truth in menu too. You want to call it an acorn squash pie, you know. But I don't believe in substitute, you know, saying it's a pumpkin bisque if we're using a different squash.
So, do you like pumpkin particularly?
Yeah, we're using a cheese pumpkin now with on the menu with a pumpkin bisque.
And this is a good time of year for squash as well.
Absolutely. It's prime season.
The book also has an exhaustive guide to oils, including flavor profiles and ideal cooking methods. Almond oil if you aren't using heat, sunflower if you're cooking over high heat. Can good oil transform anything that you're making?
It can certainly add to it, and it could distract from it too. We use a lot of grapeseed oil, and that has a lot of viscosity to it. So if you're making a dressing or a vinaigrette and you don't want it kind of watery, I use a lot of grapeseed oil, which is a very high quality oil that has viscosity to it, and it's a neutral flavor. So depending on how you're applying it, if I'm going to Provence or the south of France, which I do quite frequently, olive oil comes to mind. But if I'm doing something with, Moroccan flavors and spices, I don't want that strong olive oil influence, so I'll use a grapeseed oil or canola.
So you have to have four or five different oils in the house.
Yes, I think so. And, of course, hazelnut oil and walnut oil.
And I have friends in Santa Fe who swear by cooking their eggs very gently in avocado oil.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yes, and that's one of those oils that they really say you should only use as a flavoring oil to finish. And I'm like, really? You're cooking with it? So I have not tried that myself, but they swear by it. It's something they absolutely love.
The book begins with some notable events in vegetarian history, going back to 3000 BC and the development of Hinduism. How quickly did vegetarianism spread from there?
You know, it's interesting that it's been around for as long as it has, and yet we've evolved to a point in society where, you know, most recent polls in the United States show that 2% of the population is vegan and 5% of the population is vegetarian, which is just 7% of the population not eating meat. But when you add that to the 47% of the population in the United States that is actively looking to reduce the amount of meat they eat, you could argue that 54% of the population means that it's mainly mainstream now, that those of us who are looking to reduce or completely eliminate our meat consumption. It's
a lot of people have cut down on red meats as well, or don't eat them. They eat perhaps just fish or maybe chicken. And I would think it's hard enough for a home cook with a family, with kids. One kid is a vegetarian. One kid just doesn't want to eat any vegetables. That it would be really hard for a restaurant. But can you serve some of the dishes? For example, there's a tasting menu, officially in tasting menu here, that's all vegetarian. Blue Hubbard squash bisque, celery root apple angelotti, grilled king trumpet mushrooms. You can serve those things to the meat eaters as well, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the half of those dishes are on the regular menu. So again, when I develop a menu, I think in mind, if I made it vegetarian, would it affect the dish in a negative way? So as long as it doesn't really distract from what I really want to do and really in the flavor profiles, I'll make it vegetarian. Our matter of fact, our amuse bouche is always vegetarian, because when we have a lot of people coming, we do tasting menus. We don't want to do all separate. And I have a very small kitchen, so that also, you know, comes into factor in decision. Is, you know, if I had a large kitchen, I can do whatever I want. But it's a very small kitchen, so I kind of have to do things that are interchangeable.
Were you surprised by some of the people who turned out to be vegetarians throughout history, like Leonardo da Vinci?
Yeah, some of history's greatest geniuses. Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein.
Really? And some bad people,
spent
but
some,
we won't go into them.
There's a lot of rumors out there, and I think I know who you're thinking of, and he was not vegetarian.
What, Adolf Hitler wasn't?
No, he was not. According to the late Rinberry, who we sadly lost this year, he was not a vegetarian, and I think that was a subtitle of one of his books on famous vegetarians.
Karen Page, Terrence Brennan, Amanda Cohen, and Bart Polenza will be giving a talk in signing books tonight at 7 at the Upper East Side Barnes & Noble store. That's on East 86th Street. The book, The Vegetarian Flavor Bible, it is published by Little Brown, and it has been my great pleasure to have its author, Karen Page, and the wonderful chef, Terrence Brennan, as guests today on our show. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us. It's such an honor.